Digging deeper, job, if she gets it wrong. But Mr. Mom, I won't need her long. All I need is help for a little while. You can take dictation and learn to smile. And a temporary secretary is what I need for to do the job. I need a surgeon, and she's doing nothing urgent. What I need's a temporary, temporary secretary.
Anita! Anita!
Temporary, secretary, temporary, secretary, temporary, secretary, temporary, secretary, temporary, secretary, temporary. She could be a belly dancer, I don't need a true romancer. She could be a diplomat, but I don't need a girl like that. She could be a neurosurgeon if she's doing nothing urgent. What I need's a temporary, temporary secretary.
Hello, my precious radio listeners, and welcome to yet another episode of the radio show Sex Talk, previously called Loveline. I am your host, DJ, oh, I don't know the name of herself, DJ Late Bloomer 2000, and with me tonight is my friend Bob. Bob is a longtime friend of me, myself, here in Pittsburgh, and he is also a neurologist, and we're going to be talking about various kinds of issues related to biological issues related to homosexuality and our own experiences. So, Bob, welcome to the program. Thank you for being here tonight.
Thanks, Corey. It's a pleasure, as always.
That would be DJ Late Bloomer 2000, Bob. So, Bob, you and I were chatting in a cafe not long ago, and we were talking about our own coming out experiences. As you know, I'm struggling with my own sexual orientation. As longtime listeners of this radio show know, I'm vacillating between heterosexuality and homosexuality. But I think I've finally decided that homosexuality is indeed the right lifestyle for me. But as we were discussing, both of us sort of came out, if you will, pretty late in life. And compared especially to today's teenagers who seem to, you know, turn 13 or 14. Or 15, I guess, and they're already out. They're out in their high schools. They're out and proud. Is this a new social trend? Is this a new social phenomenon, or what?
I think it's a radical social transformation. When I was going to high school, I didn't know any overtly gay people. There was very little discussion of gay people that I recall, and when gay people were discussed, it was entirely stereotypically. These days I think there are so many resources now, fortunately for gay teenagers. The internet, I think, has been a major transforming force because of the anonymity that it affords people. And in fact, it was a factor in my own coming out, even though it was one that came much later.
So when did your coming out occur in time?
Actually, I didn't really come out until I was 35.
Really?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
35 human years.
35, and that's right. I don't know how many that is in dog years. You know.
That would be 245. But
anyway, I suppose that makes me ancient by most standards.
Ancient by homosexual dog standards,
yeah,
at least.
Yeah.
So 35, and how many? Well, I don't want you to reveal your age necessarily, but that was a while ago, I assume.
Right. That was.
And how did this come about?
I think basically it was a struggle. A lot of gay men, I don't think I really had an awareness that I was gay until I was really in my 20s. I knew there was something different. I knew that I had attractions to men that were physical at some level. I sort of wanted to wrestle with guys when I was younger. But I didn't have any overtly sexual fantasies until I was in my 20s about having sex with men. It really wasn't until my late 20s that I started, or mid 20s that I started really thinking about it.
I'd like to introduce to our listeners, DJ Juan Pablo has entered the room.
Nice to meet you, sir.
Nice to meet you, Juan.
Speaking of also, Juan, your own homosexuality emerged pretty late in life. In fact, I was the catalyst for that, wouldn't you say?
Well, yeah, except that you failed to convince me to adopt that different sexual lifestyle. So
you're now back in the heterosexual domain.
Yeah, I'm afraid the first experience was very negative, and I've never been able to, I was actually quite traumatized that sex could be turned into such a dreary experience. And I'm afraid that I'm stuck with women again.
It's possible that I wasn't at my best. After all, a little too much sangria, it dulls my abilities.
That was so pretty potent sangria, I bet you.
You have to give me the recipe,
yeah.
But you know, maybe someday you'll give me another chance. Anyway, so before these these homosexual wrestling fantasies, did you have a pretty standard kind of heterosexual teenage lifestyle? Date women, you know, the usual.
No, I didn't. I didn't really date women very much in high school. I sort of, you know, had fantasies about sex with women, but they were, in retrospect, they seemed kind of forced. I think that I, you know, felt obliged to fantasize about women. In fact, when I really let my fantasies run wild, it was they were about men and some kind of physical contact with men. Or I had fantasies about my friends having sex with their girlfriends. So they were sort of one step removed, if you will. But I did, when I was 19, I had a girlfriend, and you know, we had a sexual relationship, and I actually enjoyed it. I should say I consider myself in some ways bisexual rather than gay, but I don't see sexuality as being a dichotomy, or sexual orientation as being dichotomous. I see it as being a continuum, and I think I'm a little bit more to the heterosexual end of that continuum than some gay men, but still I would say I'm 90%. You know.
Is there, what is your name?
DJ Late Bloomer 2000.
So DJ Late Bloomer, where would you put yourself in that spectrum?
Well, see, it's interesting actually. So I sort of object to the fact that you know, that there's even a continuum. I mean, I think it's multidimensional, right? I mean, rather than being a point on the real number line between 0 and 7 or whatever the Kinsey scale is, you know, I think sexuality operates under many different on sort of many different axes, right? But indeed, I'm almost completely gay. I don't think there was only one really attractive woman who, you know, DJ, I won't mention her name, but there was one woman who almost who I had sexual feelings for, who made me wonder, you know, if indeed there wasn't a bisexual element to my personality, because she was just so fabulous, and kind of very. Anyway, I'm just sorry. I just got lost in the
technical trouble theater.
I just got lost in my own fantasies there for a moment. But anyway, this woman was fabulous, and you know, it occurred to me that maybe I had been limiting myself to men out of habit rather than out of true sexual orientation, because indeed I was very curious about her. But it never happened, and so now I'm back squarely in the gay camp.
She was in the show, wasn't she?
No, actually.
No.
She was not. Although...
I'm trying to guess who it was.
Well, although, you know, we have many powerfully arousing guests on the show, and I believe the one woman who did put her tongue in my ear was also... That was also a powerfully arousing experience. But yeah, that was just a physical reaction. I mean, that was not... It just felt very good, no matter whose tongue. I mean, it could have been an animal's tongue for all. I mean, just the experience of just of feeling that sensation on my ear was just powerfully arousing.
I think that raises an interesting issue, which, you know, one of the things that made it easy for me to start thinking about the possibility of gay sex was the fantasy that if someone was to go down on you and your eyes were closed and you didn't know whether it was a man or a woman, wouldn't it still feel the same? And so why is it that, you know, straight people, in fact, only find it erotic for a woman to go down on them and so on? In fact, I guess my second sexual experience with a guy occurred when I was in my mid-20s, and a very close friend of mine, we'd, in fact, known each other for 7 years, we'd shared a house together for a year, and we were very, I think, very close, you know, as friends, and we were sitting around one night and listening to Pink Floyd and doing what people
Pink
usually
Floyd.
Do when they listen to Pink Floyd, or did in those days.
Overdose and kill themselves?
No, we were talking philosophy, and actually it was pretty intense. But anyway, he just said, you know, out of the blue, he said, you know, I really love you. And I said, I love you too. You know, it was a very kind of platonic thing that we both had for one another, although I had a physical attraction, which, of course, I'd never shared with him because at that point I was too scared to.
Pablo,
and
I love you.
I love you too.
Right, please.
I'm waiting for something to happen here.
I'm sorry.
But I guess it already has. But it's platonic,
and my physical attraction. I'm too scared to actually.
Well, from what I've heard of this show, which is little, but I doubt that you're too scared. But anyway, it seems like there's some water under the bridge that I missed here.
But
anyway,
it's all behind us now.
So we got to talking, and you know, somehow we got onto this topic of the issue of the blowjob and you know, whether it mattered or not. And so he just looked at me and he said, "Well," and I was shocked. I was shocked. And apparently,
was this a "well, do you want to do me" look, or was this a "well, can I do you" look?
Well, as it turned out, it was a bit of both. But supposedly, it's the only time that he's ever had a same-sex experience. He's married and has kids. We're still very close friends.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And the funny thing is, he was Catholic, and I was the one who had the guilt afterwards. But I think that's
a well-known, that's part of Catholic doctrine. That's transubstantiation of guilt. That's part of.
Well, you had a little confession.
I hope I didn't offend any Catholics in the audience, but. I guess I should say he was a former Catholic.
Well, the association between Catholicism and guilt is a fantasy put forth by the Puritans anyway. But that's a topic for another show. I really agree with what you were saying regarding the blowjob. Is there something about female sensitivity that allows a woman to give a better blowjob? Probably not, right? So why shouldn't straight men...
I think, in fact, I'd argue the opposite, just from a purely theoretical standpoint.
That's right.
The argument would be that since only a man knows what it's like to get a blowjob, a man should know how to give one best.
But
clearly this is not a testable hypothesis, is it?
So maybe women have an extra muscle over here, you know, between the sides of the lips or something. We don't know. You know, it's possible, I guess.
Well, actually, I have a data point. As I mentioned last week, when I in fact seduced my straight college friend for the first time, the comment I got was, "Wow, you're really good at that."
Right.
And you know, I have to assume that.
So why do straight men like women?
I mean, I think before you answer that question, I think it's actually tied to, I mean, it's very similar to the attractiveness question. I mean, you know, repulsive, ugly people are probably potentially great sexual partners, and yet we're not drawn to them, right? I mean, so, you know, why are you attracted to one person and not another, irrelevant of gender? I mean, there's other factors too, right?
If it were purely the amount of pleasure you might receive, presumably most of these factors wouldn't matter.
Which kind of relates to the point you were making earlier about sexual behavior, at least not being uniaxial, but being multiaxial, I guess. I mean, there are so many dimensions to sexuality, right? There's the kind of intimacy thing, like who do you want to be intimate with? Who do you want to feel close to? Which you can also see on a male-female, you know, I mean, there are obviously many other dimensions to that particular issue. But if you just dichotomize things along a male-female kind of axis, you can think of, you know, the attractiveness issue, you can think of the intimacy issue, you can think of the pure sexual mechanics issue, and so on and so forth.
It's quite an ecumenical message we're sending, you know. We should try people we're not attracted to, especially if we're complaining about not having enough in our lives. And
exactly, I think that's such a, I mean.
So maybe I'll try. Maybe you should try it again, Corey.
DJ Fresh.
Whatever.
I'm ready anytime. Basically, I would actually like to point out to our listeners that if you are a straight person who's recently had a homosexual experience or ever had a homosexual experience. Or vice versa, if you're a homosexual person who had a straight experience as kind of a one-time experimental thing, or if you're anybody else, please call in and share with us your comments. The numbers are 621-WRCT and 268-WRCT. For our foreign listeners, country code 1, area code 412-621-9728.
And as he's saying the numbers, he's taking his clothes off. At least he started
there's
with
one,
a sock.
There's a very, one very seductive foot I've now revealed, by the way. That's the other thing, actually, my straight college friend told me was that I had nice feet. And so I'm not really sure what that means. Personally, I'm not. Feet don't do much for me. They're just kind of a... They're, you know, an organ of locomotion, but apparently he found it very arousing. What about you, DJ?
One no, feet don't do it for me. And just about any other part does it, but the feet, I find feet ugly. Everybody's feet are ugly to me. It's a problem. I used to know somebody when I was very young. He would go to the beach and just sit right next to people and, you know, slowly move his foot over the beach, because people at the beach don't wear shoes. Slowly move his foot over and just touch them with a toe.
That's nasty.
And it was powerfully arousing to him.
How close can you get to somebody?
What was it like for them?
Well, it was pretty.
He probably
strange.
Got a lot of sand kicked in his face.
It wasn't very offensive, right? Until you looked at his face while he was doing it. I mean, it's just a little contact.
So was this a crowded beach? I mean, you sort of hard to lay your towel down next to somebody in general. Does he play footsies at the movie theater, for example? Or?
No, I only. Well, you would first have to take the shoes off, and that's a lot more forward than sitting right next to somebody at the beach. Yeah, right. But, you know, people knew him, so he would sit right next to people who knew him, and people expected it. He got off on it. He was quite a maladjusted person, I suppose.
It's interesting. I think there are probably very few women who have a foot fetish, right? I wonder if there's any data on that, but it seems like most people who have foot fetishes are men, right?
As far as
you wonder about, you know, what the nature of the attraction is, whether there's something phallic about the foot that I'm thinking biologically, because I think fetishes are basically, it only takes a few miswired neurons or misplaced neurons in the hypothalamus to result in, you know, what we would call fetishism, which is actually a kind of pejorative term, I guess, but you know, let's say deviant sexuality on a statistical basis, right? Or, you know, attractions to unusual things or unusual.
So this is true. How is this known? I mean, are we talking? Have people done autopsies on dead fetishists or what?
No, but I think the hypothalamus is a remarkably small group of cell groups that, you know, some of which only have, you know, 10,000 or 20,000 neurons in them, and those small hypothalamic nuclei seem to be intimately involved, if you'll pardon the pun, in the specifics of sexual orientation, attraction, and behavior.
Really?
So, yeah, well, for example, there's this classic study by Simon LeVay, who's a very highly regarded neurobiologist, about the size of the interstitial nucleus of the anterior hypothalamus. and a particular cell group called INAH3, which is normally sexually dimorphic in humans. In other words, men have a much larger INAH3 than women. In fact, 2 to 3 times the size of in men than in women. And what LeVay found was he did studies on the brains of both heterosexual and gay men who had died of AIDS, as well as men who had died of other causes. And what he found was that in the gay men who had died of AIDS, but not the straight men who died of AIDS, the average size of INAH3 was much smaller in the gay men. In other words, it looked more like the size of the women's INAH3. And, you know, the study was criticized on a variety of methodological grounds, none of which I think hold water, because he had appropriate control groups in there. And he's a very careful methodologist. It's known that this same area, basically homologous areas in rats and monkeys and so on, actually is very involved in sexual attraction and sexual behavior. If you destroy this area, then, you know, male animals lose their attraction. They don't attempt to engage in sexual behavior with female rats, and it doesn't affect other aspects of their behavior, so it seems pretty specific.
That's outstanding. So can you with an MRI or something like that scan a living person's, like, could my hypothalamus be scanned to see
Well, yes, it could, but at this point, to my knowledge, the spatial resolution of MRI is not sufficient to actually delineate these cell groups in the hypothalamus. Now, there may be potential for doing that in the future, according to LeVay's work, but at this point, there isn't a way to do that. But just to kind of expand this point a little, the hypothalamic nuclei that control aggressive behavior and those that control sexual behavior are very close together. And so, you know, it's not surprising, perhaps, then that some men, you know, find wrestling and, you know, aggressive, you know, activities sexually arousing. You know, it's also interesting, if you think about it, that, you know, some fetishes that involve, like, the buttocks and so on, and other areas that are close to the genitals, right? That, you know, it might just take a few neurons that make aberrant connections to give you an erogenous zone that's not actually part of the genitals, but is nearby, right?
Well, I mean, I'm having trouble with that, just because sort of spatial locality in the body can't map to, you know, small number of changes in neuron in the hypothalamus, right?
No, well, it's the connectivity of those regions, though, with other areas of the brain, for example.
But a butt doesn't look like a penis, and so if I just destroy a few neurons, I'm not going to.
It doesn't look like a penis, but the butt is the same dermatomes. Okay, the same nerve segments. Okay, that innervate the buttocks. Okay. Parts of the buttocks also innervate the skin of the penis.
Right.
Okay, so.
Oh, so you're talking about my own butt being.
No, I'm not talking about your butt, Curry. I'm talking generically. We could talk about your butt if you like, but I'm not sure.
Dermatomes.
My point seems to be escaping me, though. So the point is, like, presumably.
Are you a neurologist?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Sorry, should I explain what a dermatome is? Should we just pass, skip it?
Yeah. Oh, no, I like the sound. I don't want it explained.
Okay.
Yeah.
My point is that when I observe someone else's body, you know, I'm getting visual and perhaps, you know, all kinds of sensory stimulus, right?
Right.
So when I see Juan's penis, you know, it activates a certain set of neurons in my brain, right? And if you wanted to shift my sexual attention 2 inches up, it's not like you could just make a small change to my hypothalamus. If you wanted to make me attracted to his belly button, you'd have to make huge changes to my brain, right? I mean,
no, because the mapping, it's not. Well, first of all, they wouldn't be huge. You'd be moving a couple of millimeters in the somatosensory cortex. But the point is, which is the cortical receiving station for sensory input. But the point is that it's that
on my body, but not on his body. I mean, if you show me a belly button, it's gonna excite an entirely different set of neurons, right?
if you show me Juan's belly button and you show me Juan's penis, they look so different that it's going to... Am I not making sense here?
I think I'm following you now. Okay, I was talking about tactile things, but I think your point actually relates to a point that I was making earlier about it could be that visually things that are similar are also sometimes considered erotic. So it's not how spatially close they are, but how visually they resemble things, right?
Right, well, so, right, okay, fine. Okay, I'm sorry. Well, so that's why I was talking about the distinction between my butt and other people's butts. I mean, I can imagine my butt.
Do you know that book, The Naked Ape? Anyway, it's an old book.
Yeah.
Naked Ape, anyway. Was that Ashley Montague?
No. No, Desmond Morris. Yeah, an anthropologist.
Well, it's an old anthropologist.
Right, that's
it's probably
right,
defunct now, but he made the argument that women have breasts because they look like some kind of monkey's ass. This is fascinating. I think the brain is wired to recognize two things with red stuff, and that's apparently why. You know, so I said the book is probably debunked, you know, by now, but it's pretty... I found it fascinating.
Yes,
you don't. Okay, well. I have to go fetch a world of friend. I'll be right back.
You've burned out permanently part of my hypothalamus, just that piece of imagery. Okay, so now that we're on the same wavelength, if you will, to continue what you're saying, I mean, there's a distinction between the things I find erogenous in my own body and the things that I sense as exciting in the external world, and those are likely to be...
Mm-hmm.
Those have the potential to be very different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
And so, for example, what makes somebody, you know, where does the shoe thing come from, since that seems to be quasi-common? Is that theorized to be like, are shoes like penises? Are shoes like breasts?
I'm not sure what the connection would be there, but, you know, it's interesting. Shoes are made out of leather, and leather has a smell to it, and that smell... it comes from skin. It's interesting, the whole fetish around leather. You wonder if it somehow has something to do with skin in some way. In animals now, there's a lot of evidence that, in fact, pheromones mediate sexual attraction and behavior and so on, and that, you know, actually they can even regulate the menstrual cycle in female animals, mammals, and so on. They're extremely potent, and who knows? Maybe there'll be a similar system discovered in humans. So.
I mean, that's sort of well known, right? A group of women living together tends to synchronize their menstrual cycles, right? After a while, is that true, or is that an urban legend? I'd hate to be spreading misinformation. You're looking at me like I'm insane.
I'm not sure if that's true. My mom always told me that. I do know that there's evidence that that pheromones can result in synchronization of menstrual cycles. Yeah.
Dr. Michael Zeiling has just entered the studio. Dr. Michael Zeiling, meet Dr. Bob.
How's it going?
I'm talking about dermatomes in erogenous zones, I suppose.
So here's my question. I mean, so maybe I'm just reading the wrong things, but whenever I hear about any kind of fetishist, it's a man. Are women, I mean, is this just much more common, whatever the fetish is, just much more common in men than in women? I mean, are there women
fetishists? Do shoes count, for example? I think shoes are a pretty sexual fetish.
Owning a lot of shoes?
Yeah.
Is Amanda Marcos a fetishist?
Well,
she had a shopping disorder. Believe it or not, the American Psychiatric Association now has recognized, I think, compulsive shopping as a disorder. Yeah, I think there was data at the APA convention presented about this being a real disorder.
Then,
in fact, Jackie Kennedy had
that compulsion.
Had that compulsion, and it ruined her relationship with Onassis. He just couldn't stand it anymore.
Well, you would think that if you have that disorder, Onassis would be the right guy to...
Well, he was, but the point is, he didn't care how much money she spent. It just was murder, though, going on holiday with her, because she'd have to spend all her time in stores.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
But apparently it responds to Prozac and related drugs, so...
Wow. Yeah. So what...
We digress.
No, but many
from
women...
the topic of today's symposium.
I would just like to jump in before you ask your question and remind our listeners to please call in at 268-WRCT, 621-WRCT if you have a question or comment or just want to ask a question of Bob the neurologist. And also, I would like to take this moment to read a public service announcement. Ferrets frolic at the Three Rivers Ferret Follies. On Sunday, June 21st, the Three Rivers Ferret Club will host its second annual Three Rivers Ferret Follies. Located at the Lakeshore Shelter in North Park, the event promises to be a day of fun for everyone, human and ferret alike. From noon to 4 p.m., participants can enjoy a potluck luncheon while they and their ferrets partake in a variety of zany games, including the flower pot excavation, tube races, ferret derby, pardon me, creative hat competition for the ferrets, and a ferret is as ferret does competition where the humans imitate their pets' antics.
I'm honest to God, this is a public service announcement.
If you are considering adopting a ferret, you may be especially interested in meeting the directors of the newly relocated Pennsylvania Ferret Rescue Association, Westmoreland County Branch, who will be attending the event. Whether you are owned by ferrets or just curious, owned by ferrets, be sure to stop by for this day of fun and education. Please note that for reasons of health and safety, all ferrets in attendance must have written proof of rabies and canine distemper vaccinations to be permitted entry. For more information about this event and other Three Rivers Ferret Club activities, visit the Three Rivers Ferret Club website at http://trfn.clpgh.org/TRFC. I believe TRFC stands for Three Rivers Ferret Club. Or contact the club by telephone at 412-431-2830.
It's good to have furry friends.
Ferrets are actually fabulous pets.
I think I know the person who wrote that ad even.
Really?
Yeah.
A fellow ferret lover.
She loves ferrets. She offered me an iguana one day, though.
Different kind,
not so furry. Species.
No,
a different sort of tectorial. I guess the dermatones react differently to the skins. So what others? What kind of fetishes there are? Okay, so there was
the iguana fetishes.
The iguana. Okay. But I think women. I guess I haven't been with a lot of people that have fetishes, men or women, but. Why do you think that women are exempt?
I read a lot of internet news groups, and it seems like the people that end up in jail or scandalized one way or another, they're always men. Women, I don't see, you know, women.
It seems like it's partly how men's more aggressive approach to sexuality.
That's what I want to know. I don't see men being arrested for, like, the new rage right now in this country is to carry a concealed camera and aim it up people's skirts. And there's these so-called upskirt websites now. With all these sort of illicitly obtained shots of women's, you know, what goes on under their dresses, their panties or whatever, and you know, men, you don't see women doing this kind of foolish zaniness. It's always freakish men. I'm telling you. Is this a trend or am I?
I don't think this is sexual in nature, though. No, it's like freakish men doing illegal things.
Well, I mean, they are well. I don't know. I mean, they must get some kind of charge out of it, and they are aiming them at the woman's genitals, which are sort of manifestly sexual.
I believe the only woman in the station wants to make a comment.
I just wanted to add that if you're talking about internet stuff, there is that woman that, like, has a live camera in her bedroom and seems to enjoy having people watching her just doing everyday things, much less sleeping with her.
Oh, that's fabulous.
So, I mean, I think that's an example of a woman kind of getting off on certain kind of fetish.
That's interesting. Do you have that URL?
Actually, we do in our lab, actually. It's kind of a group thing.
Is Alice is her name or something like that?
I don't remember.
But is it sexual for her? I mean, does she get off on it, or is it
actually,
narcissistic kind of gratification that she gets out of having all these people watching her?
Having seen only one interview with her, I think she said that at first there she did, but now that it's been up for a while, like at least a year or two, and now it's just kind of, she's forgotten about it. But at first there was a certain kind of
titillation.
Yeah.
And just more recently, there is a woman who gave birth on the internet, which was that yesterday?
But that was the some health organization doing it for education reasons. That's not a fetish.
So I can't say that no woman has a fetish, but we can at least argue that more men, vastly more men than women, appear to be getting in trouble for the fetishes.
I think maybe Michael has a point, though. I think maybe it's more socially acceptable for men to be out there sexually. It's less socially acceptable for women to talk about their fetishes and so on, perhaps. Eh? But in general, I think men again, this may be a stereotype, or a role, but men seem to be more preoccupied with obtaining sex than women as a general rule, and spend more time thinking about it. I think in studies of you know how people spend their time thinking and so on, and they're not always distracted.
Even when we're not particularly wanting sex, we have to get some. It's kind of part of our self-confidence, you know, kind of like women want it to be thin or something. I don't know.
I believe we have a caller. Is the caller on the air?
He is indeed.
Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
do you have a thought or a question for Bob the neurologist, or a comment to share?
Oh, I just have some thoughts, I guess. I guess you guys originally were talking a bit about things that you might find attractive to both men and women. And now you're talking about fetishes, and I have a couple of interesting fetishes. One, it has to do with hair, for example, which I don't know many other people that have that share this fetish with me.
This is hair on the head, or?
Hair on the head, actually, uh-huh. Yeah.
So you're attracted to hair?
Yes, in a way I am.
And so how does this attraction manifest itself? Do you like to touch hair? Do you like mm-hmm. to cut hair?
Stroke it, smell it. Huh. And I found, I guess if I were attached to a label to myself, I'd say I was bisexual. But something else I find interesting, both with men and women.
Well, that's a very unusual fetish.
It is indeed.
So I've just shaved my head, and I'm wondering if that was my own way to sort of unconsciously reject people like you, because I think you would find me very unattractive because I have almost no hair at this point.
I don't know about that, actually. It's that stubble, I guess, or.
Well, it's kind of growing up.
Yeah.
It's maybe half an inch long at this point.
Kind of like a marine or something.
What's that?
Corey kind of looks like a marine.
I don't think I'm probably too. I'm probably out of reg for marine, but it's a little long for a marine. But that's kind of the general idea.
A little long for a marine.
Is there a particular style of hair or color of hair or length of hair? Or, is there something specific about it? That's most erotic for you, or is it just hair in general?
Actually, long hair.
Do you like it clean or kind of sort of skanky, like those Seattle grunge guys, you know what I'm talking about?
Like Nirvana,
like Never Wash Your Hair. The guy Kurt Cobain, for example, never washed his hair, apparently.
Until he filled it with blood.
I would say long hair.
Long hair, generally.
Yeah. Does it address the cleanliness issue?
Have you always, as long as you can remember, since you've been having sexual feelings of any kind, have you always had this attraction to hair, or is it something that developed later?
Oh, that's a good question. I would say it's been around for a while. Since I really became sexually active.
Can you think of any early experiences that might have made some connection between hair and sexual arousal? In other words, can we come up with some kind of conditioning explanation or something
or
like that?
Or a conditioner.
Or a conditioner.
Did you see the play of hair, and did I have sex afterwards or something?
Oh, I've seen the play of hair. I don't think I had sex after it, though.
Is there a hair color that you're particularly excited by?
Black.
Okay. Well, actually, let me just interrupt. You said you had a pair of unusual fetishes. What was the other one, if I may ask?
The other one is kind of totally different, and it's in a way kind of racial, but Asians.
Asians.
And so Asians with nice hair are the best for me.
I don't think that's uncommon.
Yeah, like 90% of American men are attracted to Asians. I mean, there's a big Asian thing, especially if sort of biracial Asians are very hot.
And Asian hair is also, I think Asian men and women often have beautiful
beautiful hair.
So you have the same fetishes as our caller.
I wouldn't consider it a fetish to be attracted to Asians. Why do you consider that fetishistic? Any more than, you know, being attracted to Caucasians or African Americans or, you know.
Women or men, I guess.
What is fetishistic about that?
I think I would sort of consider it fetishistic because I sort of seek them out.
Mm-hmm.
More than others.
Right. I see what you're saying.
Obsessed with it, I guess. Right.
I know among gay men that's not, I mean, there's a distinct subset of Caucasian gay men who are attracted to Asian men. And I also think hair certainly plays a role, I think, in lovemaking and so on. I don't think it's perhaps as unusual as you might think, and certainly nothing you should feel in any way embarrassed by or ashamed about.
I'm not really ashamed of it, actually. I'm just wondering, trying to figure it out why.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Kind of more than anything else.
Yeah, is the petite part important?
No.
Okay, so large. By Asians, you mean Eastern Asians, I suppose, right?
From the Far East, yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Mongoloid.
Well, I would like to thank the caller for their fabulous insights. We're going to talk with Bob, the neurologist, a bit more about the source of these and other fetishes.
Okay.
So thanks a lot for sharing your thoughts.
Well, thank
thanks. You. Bob, the neurologist, this talk about hair and Asians and so on has reminded me of a while we've got you here as a resource, it's reminded me of a similar question. You know, my own homosexual feelings, are these things largely genetic? Is a desire for hair and a desire for men and things like that, are they indeed just sort of hypothalamic programming, or
is Trent Lott right,
or you know, how much of this is genetic and how much of this is based on my cultural upbringing?
Well, I think there's first of all, I think you have to make the distinction between genetic and biological, because I think it's possible to have a strongly biological type of causation that isn't inherently genetic. In other words, I would argue that the specifics, okay, of a fetish are not genetic, but the predisposition to develop a fetish may be. And we know that, you know, for example, let's take a neurologic disorder which has no sexual connotations, but dyslexia, for example, and learning disabilities. We know that, you know, that there are strong genetic contributions to learning disabilities. You know, there's a strong heritable component to dyslexia. But in the, you know, in the SIBs, in the brothers and sisters of dyslexics, you often find other SIBs who have attention deficit disorder or some other type of learning disability. And we also know that there's, you know, that there are areas of the brain that don't establish normal connectivity and that actually don't there's actually programmed cell death in the brain with normal development. Okay, certain cells have to die out. Cells that don't make connections die as part of the pruning of the nervous system as we age. And that doesn't happen normally in some areas of the brain in patients with learning disabilities. So I would argue, in the case of fetishes and maybe, you know, sexual orientation differences, that it's this. It's a little miswiring problem, and the predilection to develop the miswiring is genetic, but the specifics of the miswiring may be somewhat random. And, you know, there's also birth trauma. For example, birth trauma is a risk factor for a variety of neurologic conditions, and in fact, it may be a risk factor for being gay, quote, risk factor. I don't mean to use that term pejoratively, obviously, but If you had birth asphyxia, okay, if you were small, if you had a low birth weight, if you look at identical twins, the twin, often the placenta, which supplies the, you know, the fetus with blood and oxygen and so on, often the placenta in twins divides asymmetrically. The smaller twin, if one of them ends up being gay, it's much more likely to be the smaller twin. And it's also known that or it's there's some evidence that high levels of testosterone, which is the hormone that causes the brain to develop in a male direction, okay, as well as determining the development of sex organs and so on, that maternal levels of testosterone in pregnancy are associated with homosexuality as well. Left-handedness is another one. These are all, in isolation, okay, they're not very predictive, but when you put them together, I think they're often telling. I actually happen to have a number of them, so I think I fit the stereotype pretty well. Left-handed, mother was advanced maternal age. I was premature. A number of these.
And you had a twin.
I didn't have a twin. Having a twin alone is not a risk factor. It's just that the genetic contribution is pretty strong in identical twins. It's about, depending on the study, it's anywhere between 50 and roughly 80% of the identical twins of a gay sibling will become gay. And among fraternal twins, it's about 25% or so.
Wow. I would have never guessed that. I guess I'm much more of a conditioning kind of guy without knowing anything about the subject. I always tend to go for conditioning as being more determinant. So that's really surprising and enlightening.
Well, some of the other evidence, LeVay's, for people who are interested, that LeVay wrote a book called The Sexual Brain, which actually talks about the biological foundations of sexuality and sexual behavior, sexual orientation. It's actually very well written and very accessible, I think, for lay people. And in there, he points out a number of lines of evidence that suggest that actually sexual orientation is determined very, very early in age. If you look, there have been studies, for example, that have looked at basically play behavior in very young children. There are men who engage in role atypical play. So, for example, who play with dolls, for example, when they're 2 or 3, are much more likely to turn out to be gay than kids who play with tractors and Lego blocks and so on. This is obviously, I'm not trying to contribute to stereotypes here since I don't believe in them myself, but I do think there are certain lines of evidence in the developmental psychology literature that suggest that that sexual orientation is determined very, very early, and it's hard to explain.
It's kind of fascinating in a way, because I'm sure in my case that determinants of why I was gay were already in place when I was 2, and if it could have really been explained to me well at that age, which I don't think it could be, it could have been, I would have known I was gay. And then you have all these people who are 30 years old and they can't decide their sexual orientation. I can't,
So, but I'm confused. Why do you say that you knew when you were, or why are you sure that when you were 2, you knew you were gay?
Even when I was 5 or 6, I would play with myself and I'd think about guys at that age. And
maybe that was precocious puberty.
Yeah, that's more than a little turn. So, just really. So, at that age, you were sort of pre-masturbatory, and
yeah.
And
I have a bigger question. I don't know if I'm going to be able to put it out, so I won't spend much time on it in case it doesn't work. So, I'm a little confused about we're distinguishing between gay and non-gay and straight people. Very carefully, well, and even allowing for the spectrum, right? There are certainly two things that seem to be different, and you're saying totally correctly probably that it's biological. But we said before also, and it's not the same thing, but please bear with me, that it didn't matter who gave you a blowjob, whether it was a man or a woman, because it's just the sexual experience, and, well, in a sense, the giver is an object at that point. It doesn't really matter what the makeup is. I have a feeling that it's that way for everything, right? Okay, so there are certain mechanics that, a woman doesn't have a penis, so there are certain things that you cannot do with a woman. But it seems like a good lover of any sex would be better than a bad lover of any sex. Do you know what I'm getting at? If you don't, I'll stop now because I don't know how to make it more precise.
Well, I maybe you know what he's getting at. I understand everything you've said, except I don't know what your question is.
Well, that you would be determined to be gay or not gay so early on presupposes that being, how to say this, that sexual attraction, I guess I think sexual attraction is all socialized, and I cannot imagine any reason why I wouldn't be attracted to men sexually. It just doesn't happen, but I don't think it's because of anything. I'm not sure women...
is it possible that, I think most people have the capacity biologically to be attracted to members of both sexes, both emotionally and, I think, sexually. And admittedly, you know, we can't characterize all the dimensions now, but in many respects, okay? And I think it's a question of degree. What determines your predominant sexual behavior. I also think there's a distinction clearly between behavior and fantasy, because fantasy is what people, at least what psychologists generally consider to be the sine qua non of sexual orientation. In other words, if your fantasies are about men but you're sleeping with women, they would say you're probably gay, okay, or towards the gay end of the spectrum, even though your behavior is more heterosexual. But I think experience, it's quite possible to me that sexuality is not a fixed pathway, and that people's sexual orientation even may shift. I mean, we tend to think of it as being static, but the limits maybe are static and are biologically imposed, but experience may then open up new avenues and so on. For example, I think it's entirely possible that some men who've never had a sexual experience with another man never will, and never will fantasize about it, but once they had one,
right,
if the potential was there,
and maybe
it becomes 30. Erotic and so on. This isn't to say, I think, the old idea that, you know, you can make someone gay, you know, but, you know, you can convert them, you know, I think is kind of ludicrous. But
you may be right. I guess I found a better question. What is it that attracts us when we're attracted sexually? I don't think it's a penis. Well, in the case of DJ Late Bloomer, maybe, because he talks about this obviously.
So if I can ask your question in a different way, you know, so if you raised a kid in a box without any human contact at all, almost, I mean, he'd have other problems, of course.
Yes, he'd be autistic, yeah.
Right, he'd have all kinds of problems. You know, Nell, for example. Bring Nell.
Yeah.
So maybe Nell or not. But the point is, you know, in this thought experiment, you know, isolate this person from whatever social training he might otherwise get, and then put him in, you know, wait till he turns 18 and put him in a room full of attractive men and women. Who is he going to pick as his first sexual partner? I mean, I understand it's my hypothetical question has some problems. he might be a savage, but it gets at what DJ Pablo was asking, which is how much of this stuff is, you know, social training that we learned in high school and so on, and before high school, and how much of it is actually I'm attracted to.
Well, more than that, I don't think it's just the artifact. It's not the technique. It's not the penis or the breast or whatever that we're attracted to, or maybe we are.
Well, I suppose one way of looking at it would be that in the same way that biology sets the limits on attraction, okay, that society sets the limits on behavior. And so you can have constraints coming from both directions, but the full potentiality, right, may be a lot wider than most people ever experience.
Why don't we feel like having sex with the wonderful works of art? They're very attractive. They're beautiful. you know...
That's
relevant.
Boy,
I don't know how, but it is to me.
When I was a teenage boy, you know, I would get, you know, hard on playing chess and stuff like this. I mean, you know, you get very, you know, you can be attracted to anything, but you know, there's something that happens as you get older where, you know, you don't have this kind of pansexuality or something.
So I'd like to, if I may, I'd like to share a compelling story from my own childhood, and that is, I remember when I was, how old was I? I don't know, 12, let's say. And I would go over to my neighbor Gary's house, and he would sneak out his secret stash of Playboy magazine, and we'd look through them, and he thought it was great. He would get a little erection, a little, I mean, you know, we're only 12. And, you know, it was really exciting for me. I could just not figure it out. I was just like, you know, these are naked women and they're supposed to be exciting, but I just didn't. It did nothing for me. And so, what does that tell you? Apparently nothing.
Well, I think I saw, I have a female friend when I was about that age, I'm not sure how old, showed me the opposite, a magazine with naked men, with erections and stuff. And I found it interesting. I don't know if it was the illegal, you know, the dangerous activity that kind of got me interested. But I found it interesting too. Not because I wanted to have sex with this man, but they were attractive and there was...
Well, but that's the opposite story. I didn't find it this way.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
And the opposite, and despite the illicit angle.
Part of the reason could just be just the social difference between another guy who might in some sense give you peer pressure to be attracted to what he found attractive and doing this with a woman, looking at men and women. In the first place, she's not expecting you to be attracted towards the men.
Ah.
In the second place, women aren't going to be quite so insistent on you having a particular response at all.
Oh, she was checking the response. Those 12-year-olds.
She had some kind of strain gauge attached to your penis, or what? How was she checking?
No, she was electrodes, actually.
Believe it or not, that those are experiments that, you know, psychologists have used to determine sexual attraction and so on.
But they attaching something?
Yeah, yeah.
What sort of
penile
sensor?
Penile meter, or whatever they call it.
Peter meter.
Sorry. Actually, just
I'm wearing one, in fact, right now.
Yeah. I would like to tell our listeners that this is WRCT Pittsburgh. So I remember there was some study, maybe it was completely flawed, about measuring the penile reactions of homophobes versus non-homophobes when showing them homoerotic images, and the homophobic people had more of an erection than the non-homophobes. Have you heard of this? And
yes, I have heard of it. I don't know if it's been replicated, but I think certainly there are some psychological theories that would explain, you know, homophobia as basically reaction formation.
Or did you say hobophobia?
Homophobia. Yes, that's a topic of an entire other hour. I'm sure. That's right. But reaction formation, you know, the idea that you try and when there's something in yourself that you don't accept, you basically project it outwards and attach it to someone else. And
oh, so the pictures that were shown were of men?
I think
yes.
They were erotic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Images.
Huh. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all. Okay. Yeah.
It actually does surprise me. I mean, is this actually? I've always thought that excuse or that observation was particularly lame. You know, that the reason homophobes are that way are that they secretly have these feelings. I mean, that seems kind of absurd to me. Are you saying
that sounds like the reason people are anti-Semitic is because they're secretly Jewish or something?
Right, I mean, it seems like just sort of, you know, it's.
Well, one can imagine multiple, you know, possibilities. I mean, one is if you're brought up to, you know, in a extremely homophobic environment and you're, you know, a Christian fundamentalist
in that case you might go and have pickets outside gay bars, but
right.
You wouldn't get emotionally outraged like some of these people do, right? I mean, they have something personal at stake when they're...
Well, I agree that I think some people who are homophobic, in fact, probably do have strong latent gay impulses that they're defending against with the...
It's just on the surface, it just seems like...
Lots of things on the surface seem you know, implausible, but I mean, that if you believe in psychodynamic explanations, then obviously you may not subscribe to them, but if you believe in them, there are many situations where people on the surface do things that are totally irrational, but are governed by, you know, unconscious forces that they're not aware of.
Okay, I mean, just that I've been using this kind of comeback since third grade, you know. Someone calls me a name, and I'm just like, no, I'm not. You are, right? I mean, this argument boils down to, right?
Your mother.
Yeah. So, but it's fascinating. If there's actually evidence for it, it's actually fascinating. And actually, you've touched on another point, which I think answers a question, which as longtime listeners of this show know, I've observed many times that in the sort of cruising context, the look of desire from a man and a look of hostility from a man are almost the same thing. And I find this interesting, and it actually touches on the thing that you said earlier, where the kind of aggressive part of the hypothalamus, I think you said, is sort of very close to the region of sexual attraction. So,
female friend of mine used to say that men lifting weights in the gym and having sex and a snarling dog actually have exactly the same features, which is true. I found out afterwards. Yeah.
I don't know if that's true. I was actually thinking about this today, because I was thinking about, you know, like sometimes, like when I shower after swimming, you know, sometimes I look at other guys in the shower, and sometimes, you know, some of them look back at me and they look kind of friendly, and I don't think that it looks particularly, I mean, I don't find that to be a hostile look back at all, so I'm not really sure that.
Well, I think that explanation is kind of confounded, because I think in cruising, eye contact is a social signaling mechanism. Most men, most people, in fact, avoid intense eye contact with strangers, which I think is probably an inherently, you know, programmed thing to do biologically. So if you want to signal to another man an attraction and you suspect there's an attraction, you make more intense eye contact. Now,
which is the same thing you would do if you wanted to kill them or threaten them.
It is, but the point I'm making is that it's one of the few signaling systems that I think is available, okay, to indicate that you are interested in this individual, okay, that there's something that is that you want to make contact with them. You can't very well go up and put your arms around them.
Well, but there's numerous ways you could pull your left earlobe. I mean, there's numerous things you could do that are as meaningful.
But in some sense, by looking at people, you're able to form evaluations a lot better and easier. I think that's why, you know.
Well, you could look at somebody and twitch your earlobe.
But that would almost be, the nothing about twitching your earlobe would be that you would then eliminate your plausible deniability if that's what you're up to.
Ah, the plausible deniability. That is important.
It would be interesting. I mean, I think maybe you're onto something there, Corey. I mean, maybe...
DJ, fresh.
Oh, sorry.
Late bloomer.
Sorry. DJ. Maybe men who do make intense eye contact during cruising actually, maybe there's an aggressive impulse there. Maybe there's something under the surface that there really is a kind of a competitive or an aggressive undertone there. It'd be interesting to study, because
cruising is like aggressive itself, I suppose. No?
I'm the wrong person to ask, because I've never been able to cruise successfully, because whenever I look at people, they think I'm being hostile. I can't look much.
you're missing your fake cigarette today.
Oh, I forgot to bring my cigarette. Yeah. I'm starting this new trend, by the way. Smoking is really cool, there's no denying it, but it's also really bad for you. So I'm trying to get people to start smoking fake cigarettes that are made out of styrofoam or whatever. You can get these at Giant Eagle. They're 100% filtered. You don't like them, and you just carry it around all day. So I've been doing that and trying to start a social trend. I think it's working. I saw about 10 or so people sporting fake cigarettes just today. Have you seen anyone?
Yeah, there's quite a crowd.
I saw lots of people on the bus. You know, I took the
as long as they don't try and smoke the styrofoam when they get desperate.
I didn't mean styrofoam. I meant it's all filtered.
It's asbestos or something.
Cottony,
asbestos material.
Yeah. But, you know, this thing about staring and about how people interpret it, I think that when I stare at people, people tend to take it very positively. I mean, people think I'm nicer than I actually am for some reason.
But that's impossible.
I'm quite serious. I mean, like really, I actually have met people, you know, a lot of them have been heterosexual males, just by, like, staring at them in the shower, and we start talking to each other.
That's so interesting, because I have actually the opposite effect. I frighten people by doing exactly the same thing. They wonder, why is this guy staring at me? And they become frightened of me.
In fact, I made a resolution today that there's this guy that I've been seeing in the shower I'm not sure what his sexual orientation is. I don't know anything about him. But I decided I'm going to go up and talk to him next time I meet him, just because we keep on looking at each other. And it'll be very much just a social meeting. It won't have that much sexual undertones.
Aren't you making real the straight man's biggest nightmare, though, that his shower is invaded by homosexual people looking at him naked?
Yeah, but why is a straight man bothered by that? I think it's the latent, you know, the homosexual, you know. I mean, why?
Some straight men enjoy it. I mean,
every time I go there, there are at least three of you there, you know.
Well, I look at one all the time in the shower, you know.
We have a schedule. There's always at least one homosexual shower.
When the center first opened, there was the club in the hot tub there, overlooking the showers, you know. That doesn't bother me. I don't think it bothers most people, does it?
It's hard to say. I think a lot of people actually will not shower in the UC because they don't want to be looked at. And I took a shower tonight, and somebody was in the handicap stall and closed the curtain. I mean, an otherwise fully functioning person. There wasn't any sort of handicap problem, but I think he wanted to be didn't want to be looked at, I guess.
I think there are some straight guys that want to be looked at. I mean, like just for instance, this person I made this resolution about today. He has. I guess he's been lifting a lot, so he has a pretty nice body, and so he probably actually sees this as his, you know, reward for his activities, you know.
Oh, but they don't want that kind of. They want women to be looking at them. I mean, what you really want is a unisex shower.
No, attention, you know.
Attention is good. People are insecure. Yeah.
Narcissistic individuals, I think, can sometimes get gratification out of being worshipped by people they're not sexually attracted to.
You make it sound like such a thing. I'm totally narcissistic. You know, men, women, dogs. If dogs like me, I like it.
I didn't mean to be.
That's completely untrue, though. You've rebuffed all of my sexual advances.
Right. And I love them.
Oh, our producer Kate appears to be ready with a comment.
I think there's also the opposite of that whole narcissistic thing and not wanting anybody heterosexual or homosexual to see you naked. Like, I just don't even like going in the shower because I don't even like seeing myself naked. I don't, you know, I want the idea of anybody like looking at me because it just makes me uncomfortable. Not because I'm worried about whether or not they have any sexual interest in me or they're checking me out or anything. It's just
right because you know that's pretty.
I think that's a good point. I think a lot of people who don't like being looked at in the shower. Don't like it because they feel insecure about their appearance in some way.
Right. I mean, it's not just being like homophobic or anything like that. It's just like a privacy thing.
That's a good point.
So.
Yeah, I never understood that problem with nudity, actually, so I cannot comment on that.
Well, you're from a culture where nudity is revered.
Well, not when I was growing up when the country was pretending to be very Catholic and, you know.
There were all these nude photos of Francisco Franco all around. That's
yeah.
So I feel like since we've got Bob the neurologist here, we should actually ask him neurological questions rather than talking about our own shower fantasies, as compelling as they might be.
Maybe they'd be a lot more interesting to your audience, though.
I've heard too many of them already. Neurology.
This is actually not. I actually do not view the gym as a sexual place at all. I go there, take my shower, and leave. I'm not interested in looking at any other man or being looked at. I view it as a purely functional place for me to change clothes and store my equipment.
Store your equipment.
Yes. Me too.
So, Michael was telling me earlier today in the shower. That he's had only three showers since he moved into his apartment. In his apartment,
really,
he always showers here.
That's really disturbing.
Yeah.
Maybe he just likes to save on hot water bills.
Maybe he didn't tell me that. I don't know.
It's all a vicious rumor. Well, what's our next neurology question?
Well, I was actually going to touch on this shower issue since it is so interesting. I mean, there are people who kind of haunt the showers. It becomes a kind of compulsion for them. I mean, what is that classified as? You know these people that just will spend 2 or 3 hours a day in the UC going from shower to weight room to shower to sauna to shower in this kind of cycle.
Well, it depends. I mean, it could be voyeurism, right? But it could also be horniness, I suppose. Horniness, I suppose.
I mean, that's a scientific term, right?
Yes. Well, are you asking psychologically what's going on with these folks? Or?
Sure. I mean, this horniness is controlled by the dormant. What was that word? Dormant.
Dermatome.
Dermatome.
No, but that's the touch. That's the touch.
No. A dermatome, just to clarify, is an area of skin that is supplied by a single nerve root.
Really?
So, yes.
And so, why is that interesting? So
it's totally unrelated to what we're talking about now, but it was brought up.
I mean, if I confine my touch to a single area of skin, will it be like? I mean, how does this tie into sexuality? Like, is it more arousing to sort of?
Right. Is it a single dermatome or a million?
No. What I was saying is that the same nerve roots that innervate the skin of the penis also innervate some skin on the buttocks. I'm saying that may be the connection. I'm just saying there are a number of ways in which connections between...
This dermatological overlap between the penis and buttocks.
Yes.
That's interesting. That's right. We didn't understand that before.
What about like the second sacral segment innervates part of the lower sort of buttock area. And...
The lower buttock area? Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think that people who are into S&M apparently refer to this as the sweet spot or something, that there's an area just on the inside and lower aspect of the buttocks or something that's considered very erotic.
Is that what they call the G-spot in other places? Have you heard of the G-spot?
The G-spot was in the perineum, wasn't it?
I'm sorry. Yeah. I was thinking...
I thought you knew about
orifices. Yeah,
you're asking us.
This is the D spot, the dermatome spot.
Well, let's get this straight. So there's this area that's kind of like inside the
he's touching it. Please, you don't have to touch it.
Not just inside, but sort of more on the inside than on the inside half. Yeah, and lower.
And so, and what do these people who are into the sweet spot do with it?
I think pain of some sort. I mean, you know, spanking and, you know, whatever.
So if you spank someone, it's considered very good form to get, like, this particular area.
That's right.
I see.
Or so I've read. Yeah.
That's fascinating. I underwent a BDSM encounter, as listeners know, not too long ago. I didn't ask my tormentors whether they were aiming for my dermatome center or not, but actually that's very interesting.
Were they aiming in the general area?
Well, the butt coverage was pretty complete. Both butt cheeks were pretty raw, not raw exactly, but pretty bruised and welted up the next day. But I didn't check to see if this dermatome zone was had been particularly targeted. That's very interesting. So, I would just like to take this momentary pause to tell our listeners about our website. This show and all previous shows can be accessed on the web, on the internet, at http://. sextalk.wrct.com, and you'll need the Real Audio Player in order to play our shows.
Which is free, by the way.
Which is free.
Why is light touch better? Is there some neurologic explanation for that? Why is light touch more arousing, usually, I guess? Not for BDSM people, I suppose. Can you think of an explanation? I mean, we feel more with light touch, right?
I honestly don't know the answer to that. I mean, there are different sensory pathways that subserve light touch. Light touch actually can be carried by the same sensory systems that carry vibration sense and joint position sense, but also by the systems that carry pain and temperature. So it's actually the one sensory modality that's carried by two systems, in a way, or subserved by two systems.
And one of them is vibratory.
Tickle, actually. Yeah, vibratory, and the one that determines, you know, where your joints are in space carries information about proprioception.
What were you going to say about tickling?
I was going to say tickle is actually carried by the same pathway that that carries pain sensation, actually, pain and temperature.
So harder touch is only carried by one of the two.
Well, pressure. Okay. Let's see. Pressure is carried by the what's called the lemniscal system, the one that does vibration and joint position sense, I think, primarily.
Hmm. Well, that might explain. You get two for the price of one.
I mean, if there's an explanation, it might relate to which pathways have stronger connections to the anterior hypothalamus and the amygdala, which is an area of the brain that's involved in basically emotional processing and determining, evaluating the emotional or affective significance of stimuli.
Right, but if you're touching the same area lightly or harder, the same nerves, the same pathways, I guess, are carrying the signal, right?
Well, they will
arrive at the same spot?
No, they actually arrive at different spots.
Oh.
They arrive at different places, and they have those places. What I'm saying is there may be differential projections from, say, the spinal thalamic. I suspect there are stronger connections probably from the spinal thalamic system that mediates pain and temperature sensation to the amygdala and the hypothalamus, because those are areas that are involved also in fight or flight kinds of reactions and, you know, reflex defensive reactions. And obviously anything that produces pain, right, is going to be a very potent stimulus to those kinds of primitive kind of reflexes.
I think it's time for another pause.
I also want to remind our listeners, we're running out of time, and if you want to call and ask a question of Bob the neurologist, our numbers are 621-WRCT and 268-WRCT.
But there is no time to think about it. Just call.
That's right. Well, it's interesting because I recently learned in my sexual explorations with my partner that he likes to be touched very lightly. I had no idea. Apparently I have too heavy a hand. I was doing the whole, like, you know, deep full body massage move. That was kind of my standard setup of move. But apparently much more interesting is kind of this feather light tickling, and that's very arousing for him. It's just very simple to get him going with just a sort of light touch. The relevance of this comment is unclear at this point.
No, it's totally clear.
That I'm looking to kind of freak, but the.
Well, that you hadn't realized that the light touch was good before. Right? What?
So now that I understand the physiological basis of his arousal, I can use this to my advantage. You know, perhaps by keying in just the right dermatones, I can actually sexually enslave him. Maybe get him to clean more often.
You haven't already.
Sexually enslave him, get him to clean more often. That's like a 50s dream.
Get him to pick up after himself. He used to clean all the time, actually, when he was still trying to impress me. We had a spotless living.
Spotless and de-spotless as well, right?
But now that we're more comfortable, we live in pigsty. if the panel has any more questions for Rob the neurologist, we should pose them now. Otherwise, we can just put this puppy to bed. Bob the neurologist, anything else you want to share with our listeners?
No, not that I can think of offhand.
Not with those people.
Interesting, I must say it. We sort of touched on a lot of areas I didn't think we'd get into, but it was fun.
Well, thank you for joining us, and thank you for all of our fabulous listeners for tuning in, and all of the probing questions we got. Well, we didn't get any. We got this hair Asian guy, I guess. But anyway.
Kind of like crucified frogs or something rather than, you know, hair.
Right. In the kind of space of human potentiality, there are more interesting fetishes out there. But you know, not to judge. I mean, hair. You know, hair and hair and Asian. That's.
Would have more common fetishes being shared with us over the airwaves. That would be very nice. He was courageous.
So I guess we're going to close for now. And thank you all for listening. Thank you, Dr. Michael Zeilen, DJ Juan Pablo, and, of course, Bob, the neurologist. Please come back again. And thank you, Producer Kate, and
thank you,
night.
Bob.
Hi, George. Morning, Terry. Hi, George. Morning, Terry.
Yeah.
Mr. Tape Machine, watch it, boy.